Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in D.C. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him.
Service Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in DC, and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. Lunch Agenda is a podcast that schools you on parts of the food system that are less often explored than restaurants and celebrity chefs. You can check out past interviews with D.C. food justice leaders like Dominique Hazard and Lola Bloom, and national food advocates like Mark Bittman, Marion Nessel, and Julia Tertian. All the interviews are on your favorite podcast app, and behind-the-scenes info and episode picks are at kikosfoodnews.com or KikoBuff on Instagram. This February, Lunch Agenda is digging into Black food history, and I'm doing this for a few key reasons. For one, this is the first Black History Month since I became a teacher, and I'm hungry for ways to incorporate Black history into my cooking and gardening classes. But more importantly, did you know that this year is the 400th anniversary of the transatlantic slave trade beginning in the United States? The first documented Africans to arrive in the English-speaking colony of what would become Virginia arrived in 1619 from the west coast of Africa. A 14-member commission has been created to commemorate the anniversary nationally, but honestly, I have not been hearing about this moment enough. And so as I said last week, I really feel committed to not letting this milestone pass us by. Last week, I kicked off the current series in conversation with Michael Twitty, a culinary historian who dug into some of the food traditions that traveled across the Atlantic, beginning with that first landing 400 years ago, and have evolved along with the African-American community since. And today, I'm honored to bring in the voice and power of Leah Penniman, founder and leader of Soulfire Farm in upstate New York.
Thank you for this land. 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 This healing, this healing, this healing land. This healing, this healing, this healing land.
Those are the voices of the team at Soulfire Farm, a project committed to ending racism and injustice in the food system. I've been lucky enough to learn about the farm and its mission this year through a training led by their team right outside of DC at Potomac Vegetable Farm, and by poring over Farming While Black, the book written by Leah. In what time she has, I do not know. This is actually the other reason I wanted to do some episodes on Black food history. This book that Leah wrote opened my eyes to the rich, exhaustive body of traditions and legacies of farmers of color on American food and agriculture today. So Leah's joining us by phone from New York today, and I'll be asking her about many of the ways African farmers have organized, pooled resources, and supported each other in pursuit of sustaining, both in Africa and her diaspora, and also over the past 400 years in the United States. But before we begin talking, let's catch up on the week in the food system with a little Kiko's food news. Last week, I rounded up headlines related to the American diet shifting away from meat consumption. And this week, I'll report on the trendy veggie du jour, cauliflower. Sales for packaged cauliflower products grew 71% last year, and Nielsen data found the ingredient across 36 different grocery store categories. In everything from dried pasta to cauliflower rice to cauliflower, a pizza crust that is now the fastest growing pizza brand nationally. Cauliflower is predicted to move beyond the freezer section into chips in the cracker aisle, but it's still a rather pricey vegetable and limited in stock, which makes it hard to mass produce at a low price point. Second headline. Remember last year's fish scandal where e-commerce purveyor C2Table was accused of fish fraud? Well, last month, the New York State Attorney General's Office released the results of a year-long investigation into seafood fraud in that state. It found that more than a quarter of the fish it sampled at retail was mislabeled, and grocery stores in New York City specifically performed worse than everywhere else, with over 42% of seafood tested from those stores mislabeled. For example, fish was labeled as one species when in fact it's another species, like farmed salmon sold as the more expensive wild salmon. Seafood fraud doesn't always happen at the end point of the distribution chain either. It's also possible for a grocery store's fish buyer to get ripped off. Because once a fish is filleted, and if it's sold frozen, it's often filleted long before it hits the seafood aisle, it's very difficult to tell whether it started life as a red or a yellowtail snapper. Third headline. For shift workers who need to communicate with each other about scheduling and other announcements, Cork announcement boards just don't cut it anymore when they're not in the workplace. And, you know, this is a shift worker, whether you're a shift worker in a restaurant or, you know, a coffee shop or all different kinds of, you know, jobs where you don't have a set 9-to-5 Monday through Friday schedule. The priorities for restaurant and other shift workers are not the same as those for others in the employment sector. They need to be able to swap shifts remotely, and management needs to get messages to staff even when they're not in for work to attend a staff meeting. So chat messaging apps are tackling that opportunity, and Crew is one example, which recently raised $35 million in Series C funding. I just think that's an interesting new industry to watch. I could definitely have seen those being helpful back when I was working in restaurants and at Byright. Last headline for the day. A study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, using evidence from back in the 1960s, has revealed that government support in childhood reduces the need for welfare in adulthood. Food stamp access as a child, specifically from when a baby is in utero up until age 5, was found to be associated with much lower risk of diet-related heart disease and diabetes as an adult, and especially for women, higher levels of educational attainment and income. This evidence contradicts some critiques of food stamps, which argue that it's an inefficient or ineffective program. So as policymakers are debating changes to the Farm Bill, I definitely believe that this is the kind of data they should take into account, considering food stamps as a wise investment in the futures of so many young children in this country. We're going to take a quick break, and when I come back, I will right away bring Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm into the conversation so that we can learn all about what she shared in her book and that she's training her team at Soulfire Farm about. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. I'm your host, Kiko Bourne, and you're listening to the second episode in our Black Food History Month series. Last week's guest, culinary historian Michael Twitty, once wrote that, quote, "The reconstruction and revival of traditional African-American foodways means seed keeping, growing heirlooms and heritage crops, raising heritage breeds, and sustainably gathering and maintaining wild flora and fauna that our ancestors relied on," end quote. Today I'm going to discuss some of those agricultural legacies with Leah Penniman, the co-director and program manager of Soulfire Farm. Leah has over 20 years of experience as a soil steward and food sovereignty activist, having worked at the Food Project, Farm School, Many Hands Organic Farm, Youth Grow, and with farmers internationally in Ghana, Haiti, and Mexico. She co-founded Soulfire Farm in 2011 with the mission to reclaim the inherent right of Black and brown people to belong to the earth and have agency in the food system. Her 2018 book, Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide, is a comprehensive manual for African heritage people ready to reclaim their rightful place of dignified agency in the food system. Leah, thanks for being on the phone and joining me for this conversation. Welcome to Lunch Agenda.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thanks. How are you doing today?
I'm great. It's thawing out a little bit, and we're out of the polar vortex, so that's
sure
a great thing for farmers.
Sure is. It's beautiful in D.C. Are you at the farm today, or are you traveling?
I'm actually traveling this week. I'm in New York City and then Philly on book tour, and so getting to meet with youth and adults and multi-generational communities talking about my favorite topics, which are farming and reclamation of our Black agrarian history.
Sweet. I was actually going to ask you, you know, whether you're winding down the book tour as the growing season nears, or is that something that you're going to be continuing to make time for over the course of the spring and summer?
Well, I appreciate your recognition of the seasonality of our life, and absolutely. By the time April rolls around, we're running programs on the farm pretty consistently.
Right.
And my main work is to train up the next generation of Black and brown farmers and provide that support and knowledge. So I'll be mostly on the land for the summer and then picking it back up again once the snow flies.
Nice. So I want to start our conversation with an intention taken right from your book. And it's from the chapter called White People Uprooting Racism, which I really appreciated. You talk about adopting a listener's framework in that chapter. And one of the specific pieces of advice that you offered is to pass the mic. And the quote that I wrote down from you is, rather than telling or interpreting the stories of people of color, work to amplify the voices of people directly, offer your technical support so that people can tell their own stories. Mm-hmm. And I really hope today is just a chance for, you know, you to consider these Lunch Agenda airwaves yours. And, you know, I have questions prepared, but I really hope that you feel like you can share anything that you didn't share in the book, because I'm going to be drawing my knowledge from that. And I know that you're always learning. And I just wanted to start there.
Oh, I so appreciate that. I really do. You know, because so often we get in the savior mindset, those of us who care about social justice and food, and go into communities that are not our own and think we know best. You know, they need a cooking class or they need a mobile market, when in fact the experts on food issues are those who experience the brunt of the oppression. It's the farm workers, the restaurant workers, the people who are on SNAP. And so it does make sense to really tune in and listen and follow their lead. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Sure. I'm trying. So before I ask you about specific agricultural legacies from the African diaspora, I just want to share a little bit of the context that you lay out in your book for why your book is needed. So you shared that in 1920, Black farmers made up 14% of the farmers in the U.S., even though the Black population overall was about 9.9% of the country. And then fast forward to today, where 12% of our country is Black, less than 2% of our farmers are Black. And then you offered a really useful deep dive into, you know, the way that African-American farmers were systematically excluded from, you know, thriving as farmers and being landowners. And, you know, I learned from you about the Pigford versus Glickman class action lawsuit, which mm-hmm. led to a $2 billion settlement, you know, because of systemic discrimination by the USDA in the way that they had allocated loans. And, you know, the redlining that you talked about with regard to who could and couldn't get bank loans and how Black neighborhoods were given the lowest rating so that money wasn't lent there. You know, you really just gave such a comprehensive picture. So I wonder if you're able to share any policies that you're seeing at the national level or even state level that are encouraging farmers of color these days to be able to start farming, or if they are farming, to compete in the free market.
Oh, I appreciate that framing, because you're right. It's been a really challenging road for farmers of color in terms of accessing resources to which we're entitled. You know, people have been violently driven off of their land. The 6 million black folks who fled to the north were, it was really a refugee crisis, fleeing racial terror. And so, you know, for better or worse, once the USDA got sued, you know, first by black folks, then by women, Native Americans, Latinx people for not receiving the fair share of programs, they have made a concerted effort, you know, reopening the Civil Rights Division, making sure that they're paying attention to how funds are allocated. There's a long way to go. For every program I've investigated, except for EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, there still is racial disparity in terms of allocation of funds. But it is, the gap is closing. And I think programs like EQIP, as well as the Beginning Farmers and Ranchers and the Socially Disadvantaged New Farmers Programs, affectionately termed 2501, those are excellent. You know, with a grain of salt, we have to take it a bit because if you, even if you add up all of those new farmer programs and specialty crops, it only is a fraction of what is given to commodity crops and industrial agriculture. And I would like to see the entire budget inverted. But we have something to build upon.
Right. And I appreciate, I hadn't even honestly heard of EQIP. So you're building my knowledge already. I had heard about the Fair Access for Farmers and Ranchers Act. I don't know if that's related. But it's good to hear at least of a couple examples, but I completely mirror your feeling about commodity subsidies versus quote unquote specialty subsidies, specialty crop subsidies. So I want to turn to, you know, the key topic at hand here, African agricultural legacies. I was really inspired by the uplift sections of your book, which for any listeners who haven't gotten their hands on Farming While Black yet, were these special boxes on some of the pages where Leah wrote little nuggets about types of group organizing that her team has borrowed from African traditions to counter the structural oppression we've been talking about. Leah, I'd love to ask you to talk about a few of these. For example, and I apologize, mm-hmm. and please correct my pronunciation, but Ujamaa, did I say that right?
Ujamaa. But yes, I would be happy to talk about that. And just to add a little bit, I mean, the uplift sections were the heart of the book for me because as a young person getting into farming and looking around and seeing, you know, white faces at all the conferences and authoring all the books, no one had ever told me about the noble legacy of Black agrarianism and all that our folks have contributed to sustainable agriculture. I thought it was just slavery. That was our whole relationship to ag. But everything from vermicomposting to raised beds, you know, to permaculture, these are Black technologies. So that's what Uplift is all about. And you specifically asked about one of those technologies, which is Ujamaa. Anyone who celebrates Kwanzaa knows that's one of the principles of Kwanzaa. It means cooperative economics. And it's the idea that we don't have to rip each other off. We don't have to try to get the best deal possible at the expense of our siblings, that we can engage in a type of economy that benefits all of us and is rooted in relationship. And that sounds really abstract and esoteric. To concretize it a little bit, you know, what we do at Soulfire that's related to Ujamaa is our farm share. So families join the farm. They become members for the entire season. And that's a model after Booker T. Watley, who's a Black extension agent for Tuskegee back in the day. So they belong and they pay whatever they can afford to be members on a sliding scale. And then we in turn make a promise that each week they'll get a doorstep delivery of fresh food right to their house that we grew, you know, with love. They receive a lot of abundance. And in that they get a relationship with the farmer over the years.
And I have to dig a little bit because you say that Ujamaa is a Kwanzaa principle. And can you explain what Kwanzaa is overall? Because I naively have always associated it with a holiday.
So it is a holiday, and I'm no expert, so your listeners can chime in and correct me, but because our family nominally celebrates it. But it's an African-American holiday. I think it started in the 60s or 70s, and it was an attempt to reclaim our connection to our African cultural roots. So it starts the day after Christmas. We light candles. Each day is a different traditional African principle. And it's very rooted in ancestry, community, duty, and family. There's handmade gifts that are given. So yes, it is a holiday, but each of the values of Kwanzaa is rooted in a traditional African principle that guides our society.
Got it. That makes sense. That's really cool. So another practice that you uplift is the Haitian communal labor practice of konbit. And you described these as kind of semi-permanent organizations of men and women who take turns hosting work events on their respective farms. Can you talk about what the Soulfire Convicts have looked like? And honestly, my reaction to reading about that was just, you know, this disbelief that in America's crazy, you know, competitive, time-sucked world these days, people are willing to give so much work to other farms.
Right.
So, you know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. Yeah, so I'll also share that my mother's lineage is Haitian, and so this story is particularly important to me, and I got to learn about Combit directly from extended family in Haiti. We have had delegations that go work with farmers since the 2010 earthquake every year. It's been such a blessing to learn. But this idea of Combit, which you can trace back to West Africa, was called Dokpwe, is called Dokpwe in West Africa, is, you know, this Saturday you all come over and we're going to do some work on my farm, and the next Saturday the next farm, and so on. And we've adapted this to have monthly Combit at our farm, and we invite community members to come. It's been wildly popular. It's the only day we're open to the public, so maybe that's why. But we get, you know, 80 to 100 folks. We organize into work brigades, get a ton of stuff done, have a giant potluck, say some prayers, have a tour, and be in fellowship with each other. And in turn, you know, we make sure that we share our labor throughout the season with the farms in our network. So we'll pop down to Wild Seed or the Hudson Valley Farm Hub or Rocksteady to lend our labor.
And are a lot of those attendees actually farmers who bring their own skills, or are they, you know, city folks who are seizing the opportunity to get into nature and meet all of you?
Oh, it's definitely both. But okay. I'm always so grateful when farmers come. So I mentioned the Hudson Valley Farm Hub, and there's a whole group of incredible farmers with deep experience who work there. And most are they're predominantly Spanish speakers. And so when they come, we make sure we have a bilingual space. And they know how to just get things done with a lot of joy. And there's a way that we can all flow together. And I recognize their sacrifice, having worked, you know, 60-hour week, and then coming on a weekend to do more farming with us. It's really beautiful.
Absolutely. And I really liked how you shared even like the menu that you offer to the Convit attendees. You really painted a picture of the full day, and you know how you you know, recognize their contribution with, you know, veggie rich, you know, using great spices and you know, traditional dishes after the hard work. I have to say, Combit actually reminds me of like what I always learned about Amish house raisings. Have you ever like heard about that tradition? Do you think that it's at all, is it a parallel tradition, or just, I don't know, is one based on the other?
It's funny that you ask. I mean, I don't know much about the Amish, but our home, all the buildings that we built on our land are timber frames. Okay. And so we have had work parties to raise, you know, literal barn raising, house raising, to raise all of the structures, which I imagine are similar from the way that you're talking about the Amish.
Yeah. I did see that in your book too. And then the last, you know, really rich organizing tradition that I wanted you to talk about, I think I'll get the pronunciation of this one right, is Susu.
Yeah, Susu.
And, you know, you talked about how it's a microfinance strategy that is thought to have originated in Nigeria, but also has a lot of, you know, background and practice in Jamaica and Brazil, and then now in the U.S. And I know that they exist even in East Oakland these days. I was wondering if you can just talk about how those work and what your Susu group has allowed Soulfire to do.
Sure thing. Yeah, so for those who don't know, Susu is a mostly women's technology. It's used in the Caribbean and across the diaspora. It has roots in West Africa. And it's a proto-credit union. You know, people chip in a set amount of money at a set interval, and then on a rotation can take out a loan or grant from the group, depending how it's set up. Interest or no interest, depends how the Susu is set up. And what's amazing about this is it allows people who don't have a lot of capital to pool resources so that they can make larger investments, whether that be goods for their market stall, in new livestock, a house, and so on. And when we were, you know, we were blessed enough to be able to purchase our very inexpensive land out of pocket because we'd saved for many, many years. But then we had no money. And that was a minor expense compared to a house, a well, a septic, electric, you know, all the things that needed to go into the property to make it suitable for human habitat. And we were denied a bank loan because the bank did not want to fund a farm. They did not want to fund a straw bale construction or alternative construction. And we turned to our community, who had a lending society called Money Game that works very much like a SUSU. And we were able to join, you know, build up credit with that group and then take out a mortgage to create our home and to create Soul Fire. So we credit that informal lending society and structure for being able to, you know, lay the foundation for what was to come.
Have you heard about many of those type of lending societies around the U.S., or is it pretty unusual?
You know, only for the book, I had to do some searching about how prevalent it is. And it turns out that there's a few, you know, even online SUSUs that you can join. So it's more prevalent than I realized. But it's certainly not out in the open. I haven't run into any signs that say, come on in. Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear you describe that and the other practices we've talked about as technologies. You know, speaking of online lending societies, I just, you know, you associate technology as this modern thing, and then these are practices that have been around for centuries. Can you just explain why that word is how you describe it?
Oh, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a reason that I can articulate very clearly, but perhaps it has to do with respect and honoring. So we might say, for example, that the Heber process that takes nitrogen out of the atmosphere and turns it into fertilizer is a technology, but maybe we would not say that the symbiosis between a rhizobial bacteria and a legume that takes nitrogen out of the atmosphere and turns it into soil nitrogen is a technology. But of course it is, right? Like nature is doing this. And then when folks like Dr. George Washington Carver, black scientists at Tuskegee, figure out how to take what nature does and scale it up so that we can heal the depleted southern soils and be able to make a life again, you know, that's a technology. It's cover cropping, because it has the effect of improving our lives and making this big leap, this substantial step.
So what I'm hearing from,
it's honoring. It's just honoring.
Yeah, and honoring human innovation. Maybe that's what it is like humans had to create these notions in order to, you know, help each other in these specific ways. And I do think that it's amazing to relearn the history of Dr. George Washington Carver, because I remembered that name, of course, from school growing up, but I never had him as an agricultural leader. And back when I was learning about him, I wasn't as, I guess, quote, food interested as I am today. And just to learn about how forward thinking he was and how he, you know, believed that forests, for example, were these natural fertilizer factories, and that farmers should dedicate their autumn and winter to like collecting all the forest matter. Is that something that you do at Soul Fire?
It absolutely is. It was so affirming to see this, because Dr. Carver he'd really just admonish the farmers for being too lazy in the winter. He said, you know, once you've pulled your crop in, you think you're done, but this is the time that you need to actually give back to the soil. And he was out there quoting Bible verses about, you know, how we need to treat the soil as if it were in the image of God. I mean, really, really incredible. And he was telling farmers they had to gather leaves, gather muck from the swamps, compost, and spread that compost. So of course, you know, that's what we do. And it was so affirming to learn that necessity, that compulsion really came out of our own Black agrarian tradition, that we were carrying that on.
And you mentioned vermiculture earlier, but I just think it's so cool. I want the listeners to also know about the legacy of Cleopatra, and because soil studies are definitely coming back into like mainstream, you know, food studies, conversations, but the fact that she, you know, so made the earthworms this sacred thing that people were prohibited to remove from the land, and therefore, you know, the Nile Valley's soil was studied and to be like the most fertile in the world. That's just an amazing legacy that you shared, and one that I'm actually planning to teach my kids about later on this month, while we're stuck inside with our worm bins.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah, I mean, of course, there was the flooding that helped the Nile River Delta be so fertile. But even more, Cleopatra made it illegal to harm a worm because she recognized the worm's sacredness and importance in soil fertility. So she had a whole cadre of priests dedicated. Their full-time study was dedicated to learning the habits of earthworms and protecting the earthworms. And that's why I think in 1949, the USDA found about 10 times more worm castings in the Nile River area than in the United States.
So cool. So Leah, one thing that I am really grateful for you sharing on your website, actually, or on the Farming While Black website, is songs that you bring up in the book. And you talk about how African Americans are a singing people, and many of the songs heard on farms today derive from African traditions. So I appreciate you saying that I could share one of them, which is an I don't know if I'll say it right. Igbo song from Nigeria, and it translates as "My God, you are so good." So here's that song.
Chineke idema o idema, idema e idema o idema, idema e Chineke idema o idema. Idema e, idema o idema, idema e.
Leah, my sister has worked on a bunch of farms, actually a lot of them in New York, and one of them was a singing farm. And the crew there used song to create rhythm and unity for their physical work. And I don't know any of the songs specifically that they sang, and I don't know if they were African traditional songs, but I do know that something that seems like it could be an issue with these songs is, you know, a feeling of appropriation and, you know, and who is singing them and why and how. To be totally honest, the Thank You for This Land song that I played earlier in the episode, it's been in my head and I feel a little strange singing it, and I don't know if I should or why. What is your wisdom on this dynamic?
Well, I'm certainly not the authority on just differentiating between cultural appropriation and cultural sharing. I think it's important to check with the originator of whatever it is, whether it's a fabric design, a recipe, you know, a technology like yoga, to see what their guidelines are. I know for myself, I think about consent and reciprocity. So I think about, was this freely given? You know, was it shared? Does the person or people want to share it? And then what does reciprocity look like? So if I'm going to profit from this in some way or benefit, what am I giving back to those folks and making sure that that dialogue happens too? Which is still a squishy boundary, but at least gives me some guidelines.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And so the last kind of little bucket of nuggets that you talk about in the book are related to African agricultural traditions that were exported from Africa when slaves were captured and brought to the United States, is like hard farming skills and tools. And I'd love to talk about a couple of those in the last minutes of our interview. So for example, you talk about the Carolina rice industry and how, you know, that crop required such specific skills of creating embankments and canals and dikes. And, you know, because the slaves that made that crop successfully in the United States were so successful, you know, more and more were brought there. But you also talk about that black farmers are often or rarely credited for their contributions to rice production. I want to say, why is this? But I know the answer to that. So,
right. I mean, it's profound what you bring up, because, and folks should definitely check out Judith Carney's book, Black Rice, to learn more about this. One whole strain of rice is of African origin. Another one is of Asian origin. But, you know, something I didn't know is that white enslavers weren't just going around kidnapping people with big muscles. They were intentionally targeting the best farmers, because in the climate where a lot of the enslavers were coming from, they didn't know how to do tropical or subtropical agriculture. They were in very temperate, cold regions, and they didn't know how to grow the crops that grow well there. So they were intentionally, you know, finding people that had these skills, which decimated the African continent of many of its best farmers, and also you know, in turn built a $10 trillion industry in today's dollars in terms of the agriculture, and Carolina rice being one part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That is an interesting kind of easy myth to fall into, that you talk about, and how it was more strategic and more like, you know, I ultimately all economically driven, financially driven. Mm-hmm. And one last hard, you know, farm item that you talk about is the hoe, and how how this tool, which is used to open up new ground and plant and harvest, is really symbolic of African contribution to American agriculture because of how it works when used in community. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Definitely. So the hoe is one of the oldest agricultural tools. It's the most widely used, and it does have origins in sub-Saharan Africa. And when I think about the hoe, I don't think about those chintzy little, like, Home Depot or True Value hoes. We're talking about those big honking ones that you can break new ground with. You can get them in Haiti, get them in West Africa. And what's amazing about the hoe is that it works best in community. It works best in kumbit when you're all in a row. You know, using it in rhythm, you're able to build your raised beds in a way that is not backbreaking, in a way that is joyful. And it's incompatible with tractor agriculture. You can't do those both at the same time. And so I think the hoe is symbolic of the way that Black agrarianism really is rooted in community, and a sense that we're part of a super organism that's greater than the individual.
And so would you go so far as to say that Soulfire doesn't even use a tractor?
We do, but we don't use a tractor for tillage. So we're a no-till farm at this point. Mm-hmm. We use a combination of hand tools and tarping and heavy mulches in order to manage weeds and keep the grounds open for crops. But we do use a tractor to move things around.
Okay. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. So I feel like a lot of the questions I've been asking you are things that you know, you've written about. So I'm going to ask you a harder question as my last question before your action item, kind of about what opportunities you see. And my question is, as I said, I attended one of the Undoing Racism workshops that your amazing team led. And I know that's a huge part of your mission. I'm curious about what's not happening in them yet. Like, what's not catching on? Which are the principles or hopes or commitments that you make to your team, or that you've kind of set intentions about, do you feel like is just like, it's not clicking yet and, you know, really needs more work and more attention and more time?
You mean within Soulfire? Like, what is that area of growth?
I guess I mean
in the movement.
More in the movement, more in like in the trainings that you see, like what's not being accomplished yet?
I still think there's just this way that we still invisibilize the folks who are doing most of the labor on farms, mm-hmm. and compartmentalize that. So in this country right now, 85% of the food is grown by Spanish-speaking people who were born across the border. Many of whom do not have the same labor protections under the law, no minimum wage for the smaller farms, you know, no right to unionize, being forced away from their families and homelands and subject to terror by ICE. And somehow that gets in this other bucket around immigration and is almost completely ignored by the food community, including the really progressive food community. And so I think of all the areas of ignorance and areas of growth, it's figuring out how at the farming conferences, they're also farm worker conferences, and we're doing really doing that work together, honoring the people as well as the people who grow the food, as well as the land that helps nourish and bring forth that harvest.
I really appreciate that. There's one episode of my show, if anyone's curious, back last year in spring, about food distribution, and a friend of mine named Jose talks about how he grew up the son of pickers and about how many humans touch each fruit and vegetable that we get, and about how it felt for him to pick. And I do recommend that episode. It's in the food distribution series. So Leah, we're at the point where I ask you for your lunch agenda action item. The one thing that you would like listeners to do in our day-to-day lives to improve our food system in a way that you think it needs to be changed?
Well, I hope that everyone who's listening today will go to the Reparations Map, which is a national project that we have where Black and Brown farmers and farm workers put up what they need in order to be able to feed their communities. It might be as big as a tractor or as small as encouragement. The Reparations Map can be found on our website at soulfirefarm.org, and you can pick a project near you and lend some support to a Black or Brown farmer who needs your love, your resources, whatever you can give.
That's extremely tangible. Thank you. And I can vouch for the fact that it really, I mean, you guys give so many examples, whether it's, you know, copy editing or a little donation or, you know, everything in between. I like, you know, how you started encouragement. So the Reparations Map on the Soulfire Farm website is Leah's action item. You can follow Leah on Twitter at Soulfire Farm. You can follow her on Instagram at Soulfire Farm. You also have a Farming While Black Instagram account, I noticed. So today we talked about how Soulfire Farm is inspired by and successful because of a lot of the traditions that inspired Leah and her team, that began in Africa and exists all across the diaspora countries. Next week, I'll be finishing the series in conversation with a local activist, Tambor Ray Stevenson, who founded WANDA, which stands for Women Advancing Nutrition, Dietetics, and Agriculture. And Tambor's focused on really working with women and girls to create healthy communities in Africa and definitely in this Washington, D.C. area. She did an amazing presentation for all of my students at Mundo Verde, and she's on the D.C. Food Policy Council, and she has a lot of wisdom in this area. So I hope you'll join us. There's a lot of ideas she'll share for honoring the 400th anniversary year of the beginning of slavery in this country. And whether you're an educator or a parent or a history buff, I think it'll be a good conversation. Leah, thank you for squeezing in this conversation with me today, and I will continue to follow your work, and I wish you a really fruitful growing season ahead.
Thank you. I wish you a wonderful season as well. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. This is Kiko. You were tuned into Lunch Agenda, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.